Why does prayer work? And Sharon was contrasting, you know, she prays for Swamiji and her prayer seems superfluous. And she prays for her family and her prayer seems so unrelated to their reality, how could it have any effect? And then she said, I haven't been to a prayer class lately, just in case I'm going to say what you should have been. Sharon warned me that she was going to ask this question, so I've been reflecting on it a little bit. No, it's important to realize that everything that happens on more subtle levels is modeled, M-O-D-E-L, modeled in the world that we understand. When I read Master's Bhagavad Gita commentaries, and he gives all these descriptions of the more and more subtle worlds, which I've often commented, and if you've read them, they're just list after list of all these just amazing details of these various planes of consciousness. And he states them very emphatically. You know, this dimension of reality is composed of these 17 elements which break down into the five elements of the so-and-so. And it, not that I understood a word of it, but I was struck by the fact that it was so exact. It was just the same exact science that chemistry and biology, that everything in this world that we can understand with our senses and accept as true fits into a nice orderly pattern, and there's no point at which it changes into chaos or randomness. Or more true, it's that this world we live in is a projection of a more subtle world. We tend to think of the pyramid going this way, which is this is the material world, and then it gets smaller and smaller. But it actually is in reverse. This is the world beyond this one, and it gets smaller and smaller down here. As someone said, this is the most contracted our consciousness will ever be right now, rather than the most expanded. This is the littlest point. But understanding that, we have to realize that the relationship, all relationships are the same. And everything that applies in our everyday life, it's true even if the relationship is more subtle. So we sort of have to ask the question of how do we help each other at all? And helping each other through prayer is not fundamentally different than the way we always help each other. I was thinking, for example, my nephew's staying with me and I wanted him to clean up his room. And he didn't want to clean up his room. It wasn't exactly... I finally realized it wasn't that so much they didn't want to, as that he just was sort of dismayed by the mess. And so I went up there and I sat with him. And I suggested that he, you know, first he clean up this part of it, then he clean up that part of it, then maybe he could do the bed. And about halfway through he said, with two people, this is easy. And I wasn't lifting a finger to touch anything. I was just sitting there, giving him energy, you know, and helping just kind of nudge it here and nudge it there, to kind of get him over the hump of thinking that it was more than he could do. So it isn't as if I caused it to happen, did it for him, or changed his destiny. But because I was giving him energy, he was able to muster the energy to do it himself. And on a certain level, you can say, it's his good karma to have somebody sit up there with him and help him do that. So it's not like it was extra to his life. Because this would have to be a very long, sort of complicated picture of how he was born to my sister and how he happened to, you know, she and how she and I happened to be sisters and how he came to me and how he happens to have a good heart and how I happen to like him. You know, you'd have to put all that together to say that it was destiny that he would have me sitting there to help him clean up that room. It was unavoidable. And it was part of the whole cosmic plan that I would be there to help him, that he wouldn't be left all on his own to try to flounder around and figure out how to do it. So when we pray for people, and at the same time, if you think about that relationship, there was an art to helping him do it that was neither too oppressive to him nor too helpful to him. It was just like hitting that right balance where I was just giving him the right kind of energy. So when we pray, we talk about, and Swamiji talks about, it's very important not to define for God what's supposed to happen or use our prayer as a way of just expressing our fear. You know, that it has to be a certain way. It's not that we can't have opinions or that we have to hide our desires. But we always have to be careful that we're not actually praying for ourselves, that we're praying for someone else. So Swamiji always encourages us to that the best way to pray is to give energy. Because just like my nephew had the capacity to clean up that room, if I just gave him a little bit of energy, then he could do it. And so when we pray for people, almost always if a situation is difficult, which would be why we'd be praying, or maybe it's just regular normal life, everyone, pretty much everyone knows what to do. And if their conscious mind doesn't know what to do, their soul knows what to do. But most of the time when we're stumbling at all, it's because we have a lack of energy, or we have fear that blocks the energy, or we have fear that causes us to be afraid to reach out or to face reality or whatever any of those things might be. And if you can just surround whoever you're praying for with energy, then it's like it just gives them a little boost. And it was karma that somebody would pray for them, you could say. So they were destined to get that little boost. And on a subtle level, well, here's a real specific example. Happy Winningham, who had AIDS and was sick for 8 or 9 years, all, you know, up and down many times. One of the times when she was dying and went way out but came back, she started going way out, and she heard what sounded to her like thousands of people calling her name, all in a very sort of joyous, loving way. Happy, happy, happy. And it got her attention, and she came back. And she recovered and then lived on for some period of time. And what it was, she realized, was the people all over the world, because Ananda's so interconnected, the word went out across the wire that Happy was in the hospital and looked like she might die, so everybody started praying for her. And so she just heard this chorus of people just sort of giving her loving energy. And they weren't really saying, don't die, because no one felt that. They just were just calling her name, just out of sheer exuberant friendship. But she took that energy and used it to bring her back, because that was what her soul wanted to do. Maybe she would have come back anyway, just to say, you can't draw a piece of it out. Now, most of all, that's why... Now, there is a modifier to that, because I remember when there was someone that I cared about a lot that I really wanted to come onto the spiritual path. The person was beginning to get interested in spiritual life, and I figured, well, if they're going to get interested, they might as well get interested in Ananda instead of something else. And so I said to Swamiji, is it okay for me to pray that she get on this path? And Swamiji said, oh yes, of course, because it would be very good for her spiritually if she did that. And so in that particular case, I did pray to Divine Mother that the person get on this path, and they did. I don't know if it was my prayers that tipped the scale or not. It would be the same sort of thing. It was sort of like I was saying, hey, look over here, you know, kind of like that. And just like a person walking through a crowd and sees somebody waving their hand, oh, maybe I'll look over there. And maybe it just sort of sucked them in a direction that they might have gone anyway, but it helped them go that way.
So we add energy to other people's readiness and their own karma.
Sometimes you'll pray for people and they'll get worse, because your energy has been received and the right thing is happening. Yeah. I mean, sometimes they'll just get worse, because, I mean, worse meaning they're an alcoholic and they'll drink more. You know, they're... unresponsive, and they'll become more unresponsive, because whatever the karmic loop is that they're finishing, they have to finish it. And you give them energy, and then they'll go on with whatever their will may be. But, I mean, St. Augustine said that the reason he became a saint is because of the prayers of his mother, who is known as St. Monica, because he was a dissolute, and she just wouldn't give up. And he felt that the just unrelenting commitment of his mother to draw him to the spiritual path, he finally just, you know, the power of her clarity was stronger than the power of his delusion, and it just drew him into it. So, if you think of it in terms of the power of friendship on this plane of consciousness, and how profoundly your life can be affected by a true and loving friend, who regularly, continuously, faithfully responds to your real heartfelt need, that's exactly what prayer is. And in just the way it works on this planet, That's exactly how it works. Sometimes it takes a while before you realize your friends were right. Sometimes your friends just can just sort of hold your hand while you go into chaos, you know, but eventually they're there. On the highest level, I was thinking of those wonderful stories about Ramana Maharshi, who was a great, saint. He lived into this century. And there were two stories that I heard that were tied together that were amazing. He was a very, very austere man. He lived in southern India. We went to visit the ashram where he used to live, very, very powerful place. And he had a very devoted disciple, and that disciple was dying, and Ramana Maharshi came to him and sat with him. And he helped this disciple in the dying process by keeping his attention, the dying person's attention, focused on the spiritual life. And by just constantly being such a strong presence with him, that it's like the man was able to resist the temptation to go with a lot of lower vibrations than just the pure light. Except toward the very end, now, and I can't quite remember now whether the man had actually apparently died or was it just before he died, but for some reason Ramana Maharshi was persuaded to walk away from him for a moment, maybe to bathe or something like that. And he said, and in the moment that he walked away, he just slipped down a little and slipped out in the lower vibration. And so Ramana Maharshi said, you know, he was almost liberated, but because I withdrew my energy a little bit of karma got him. But of course, there wasn't much left. So later, when Ramana Maharshi's own mother passed away, he absolutely refused to leave her side for anything. Because he said, well, the other man slipped away, so I'm going to stay with her. But, and of course, we're talking about a very high master at that point. But still, it's the same principle, is that he was there and he was just radiating such a strong thought. Just like, you know, if you're with someone and they're strongly, they have a lot of courage, for example, if you're doing something and you're a little bit afraid, but somebody else isn't afraid. I remember when I tried to climb the Duomo in Florence, Italy. You go up these narrow stairs and then you have to walk around this catwalk, which is way up there, to go up on the roof. And the first time I tried to do it, I just panicked at the height and literally ran down the stairs and ran outside and panicked. And the next time I went, I was determined to be able to do it, and Nancy Kendall just has a lot of courage like that. And I literally held onto her skirt, and I held her skirt and watched her feet. And I just didn't look at anything else, and she just marched me all the way up, and I think Linda was there, all the way up onto the roof. And I was just so proud of myself, but I could never have done it without Linda and Nancy, because I was just too scared. It just, the karmic fear of heights was too great. But I stuck with them, and I made it all the way to the top. You know? And they didn't say anything or do anything. They just radiated their own confidence, and I could say over and over again, you know, these are sensible people, and they're not terrified. I can do this. And in the same way, when we pray for someone, oftentimes, and I was just thinking of Ramana Maharshi, I mean, he just projected this thought of clear light, and so he was able to pull his mother right into that. And so we project this thought, and we pull people into it. Now, there's specific questions about Swami. I think praying for Swami he's not liberated, and therefore our prayers count for something. I don't know if our energy is high enough to touch his energy. But nonetheless, I think it goes in the great book of life. That's how I always think about it. I just figure, because of the extraordinary gift he's given to so many thousands of people, we all pray for him. You know, every time a mosquito bites him, everybody in the world, thousands of people in the world pray for him. And I think that has a cumulative effect. And it's a tremendous thing for us to do, because it puts us in right relationship, because what else can we give? You know, he's given us on a level that when, what can we give him back? We give him pajamas or, you know, a pretty cup or something. But it's like, what can you really give? You give your heart's devotion. I remember how touched he was when someone gave him a birthday present, and she said, I'll meditate and pray for you for an hour. That was the birthday present. We thought that was so sweet. And there was no thought of, oh, I don't need this or anything like that. It was just what a dear thing to do. Because it's an expression of our refinement. And exactly what you said, you get into by giving that energy out, you get into. As for our families, we help them enormously because no matter how ignorant their egos may be, their souls are wise. And it's a great blessing. And that's why it really doesn't matter if your families are very upset with you on an ego level for your spiritual life. Their souls are really quite pleased. Because they know that it's money in the bank as far as their lives are concerned. There's an automatic blessing that stands out. I mean, they even say when you're liberated that your own family in seven generations is liberated also. I don't know what that, Swamiji said, I don't know what that could possibly mean, because a lot of times you've got really worldly relatives. But it just must mean that there's some, you know, dynamic force that goes out to them. But in the case of people who are very worldly, it's very hard to kind of tune into their consciousness. You have to tune into their soul and just project light to the part of them that knows better than the part that doesn't. And just, it's almost like you pray to their superconscious. Do something with this fellow, please, you know? See if you can get through. Sometimes. And you don't tell them, necessarily. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's friendship, on a subtle level, that's all. Linda?
When is it okay to pray for oneself? You said earlier that you don't pray for oneself.
Oh, no, what I meant by that particular phrase was that you pretend you're praying for someone else, but actually you're just trying to satisfy some desire of your own. But the question is, the real question you ask is, when is it okay to pray for yourself? I think you can pray for yourself all the time. I mean, great saints don't. When Ramakrishna prayed to be healed, because people kept telling him that he ought to pray to Divine Mother to be healed, she scolded him. She said, here are so many bodies and you're praying for this one? So for him it was not appropriate. But most of us need to pray because we just need help. That's all you're praying for. It's our relationship. It's the same thing. Think of it like a regular relationship. If you really need help and don't ask for it, oftentimes people can't help you. And in our relationship with God, if we don't ask for help, especially with the Guru, I mean, it's not precisely true, but it's partly true that God won't intervene with our free will. We need to open ourselves and ask for that help. That's our humility, and our discipleship requires that we do that. So I would have no compunction about praying for oneself. And if you're praying for a particular condition or circumstance, you can sort of pray like Jesus prayed, Lord, let this cup pass from me, but thy will not mine be done. So I've prayed in my life, you know, Lord, this really looks like what needs to happen. You know, I think this is what really needs to happen. Please make this happen. You know, and if I'm wrong, show me I'm wrong. But unless you show me I'm wrong, this is what needs to happen. And Swamiji said again in that one, when we were, for example, trying to get the property that's now our community, I asked Swamiji, because of other things he'd said, if it was all right to pray, you know, for that to work. It was more just generally to pray for the community, to have a community. He said, of course it's all right to pray for it. You don't have to be that nervous. He said, it's self-evidently a good thing. You know, so we don't have to be so cautious about having an intention. If something is self-evidently a good thing, he said, just put your energy behind it. There's no harm in that. So if we're praying for ourselves in ways that it's self-evidently a good thing. If we're praying for something that is not good for us, and we're just praying for it because we want it, that's a waste of a prayer. But if we're very sincere, and it's the best we know, and sometimes it's best if you're praying for yourself, the same as when you're praying with others, to get it down to the essence. Instead of praying, oh Lord, can I have that job? Just, you know, give me the strength to find the right employment. If this is the right thing, show me how to respond properly. You know, when I go to the interview tomorrow, guide me in what I need to say. It'll be very instead of make them like me. You know, which is not about empowering yourself. Yes.
Last night in Wayne's class, we were talking about something that Jesus said. I don't quite have, I mean, I can't quite quote it correctly, but if you pray to God in full belief, what you pray for will be given to you. Mm-hmm. Do you know that quote?
I've heard something like it.
I don't really understand it.
Pray believing?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is it pray believing?
Pray believing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Pray believing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, what he's talking about in that context is that if you're fully in tune with divine will, if you're fully in tune with the divine energy and divine law, and your will has become one with the divine, then whatever you put your will manifest. That's not the same as saying that the ego has really convinced itself that it wants it, and it prays believing that the ego really wants it. That's not what the words mean, even though you could make them sound like that. It's a question of it's also a question of believing in our own power, believing in ourselves as one with the infinite, believing in God as a loving Father, believing in the power of faith to move mountains, believing in Jesus as the Guru, you know, believing all of those things, having all of those divine realities completely a part of one's own nature, not merely as an idea, but as a state of realization. If all of those realities are in place, then we become instruments. You know, we become direct channels of the divine force. And when we pray with that kind of force, then we are one with the universe. Nothing can resist us. But again, that's all very different. See, people translate that into meaning, but I really wanted it, and I prayed really wanting it. But see, the whole problem with the Bible and all the teachings is the pronoun I. Because I, when Jesus uses it, means Christ consciousness. And everything is true and the problem then comes to us that we use the pronoun I, and we have this theoretical idea philosophically that I am one with the infinite. But the real power of our energy when we say I is the ego. So we try to activate divine law. I am one with the infinite, I can manifest, I believe. And it doesn't work because we haven't yet transferred our sense of I from ego to Christ consciousness. And so we're saying all that I can do all this, but the I that is speaking and saying that isn't the I that can do all that. So in order to make that final point work, which will work, is we have to do all that which is necessary to move our consciousness from the medulla to the spiritual eye, and move from being evil, and then it all is true. Does that make sense?
So believing is a state of consciousness, a higher state of consciousness.
Believing is a higher state of consciousness, that's well put. Yeah. And when you're in that higher state of consciousness, everything works, everything comes as you pray for it. But it's also true that if you merely believe that God is a loving God and loves you and will respond, then your prayers will be answered. That doesn't mean they will be answered in the way you expect. So if you pray believing that which you pray for will be given to you, it's true even on a very low level. If you pray really believing in the infinite, you will get what you pray for. You will get what your soul is really praying for, not necessarily what your mind and your mouth is saying. Do you see? So that's another way to interpret it. Yeah. It's all very tricky. And also very simple. In the Bible, Jesus also sort of models all the different miracles, or all different ways. Some are by willpower, some are by devotion, some are by surrender, some are by the power of words. So you go through all the different miracles in the Bible, and Yogananda talks about each one is like a different expression of how to be attuned to the Spirit. Just like when you go through scientific healing affirmations, some of them are willpower affirmations, some of them are intellect, some of them are devotion. So that you have different, the word in India is balls, different attitudes of devotion can be expressed in different ways. Question is with breath and all the different ways that we relate with it, the way we use it in yoga, use it in meditation or energization. I am not able to speak on the level that many people could because I'm more of a bhakti than a technical person. So I'll answer more from just that level. You know, I can give you a lot of words. It's almost the same answer to the question that Sharon was asking too, in the sense that everything that exists on this plane exists on more subtle levels. And breath is just the definition of life. When a baby is born, if the baby, you know, even if the baby looks perfect until that baby takes the first breath, there's no certainty that the incarnation will ever start. Yogananda says that the reason the baby cries when it takes its first breath is because once when it takes that breath, it recognizes that it's done it again. No. That here I am. I'm really here. I'm in this material body. I've come out of the astral world and I'm in this helpless, you know, weeping little body. And here I am, oh my God. And so it just cries out. That's what Yogananda says, at least. And astrologically, they time the birth from the first breath, not from the emergence of the baby, but when the baby first cries. Because that first inhalation, that's when it starts. And there's never a point, unless you are a yogi and can stop your breath, that you don't breathe as long as you're here. It's the manifestation of the energy that ties the soul to this body. Because once that breath stops, I know when my friend Paula was dying, and there was a large group of us in the room with her, and she announced, you know, basically that this was it. This was the last minutes of her life, the last half hour, and she went very deeply silent and was just breathing. And I mean, everybody just listened to her breathe. It was just so. It was just like we're all just listening, and it was just so interesting to. It was like the breath would go out, and then there'd be this long pause, and we'd all think that was it, and then she'd go, and she'd pull it in again, and okay, and then it'd go out again, and there'd be this long pause, and she'd pull it in again, and finally, it went out for the last time and didn't come back in. But it was so dramatically clear that as long as she kept taking that breath in, her soul was still in that body. And it wasn't until she just let it out for the last time. Now, that's a clue, you know, that if you could follow that. I always think of it as the Minotaur, Theseus, and the labyrinth, where he had to go in and slay the dragon, but then he had to also get out. And the woman who loved him held a spool of thread, and she tied that thread around his hand or something, and he went all the way in and then slayed the dragon, and because he had that thread, he knew how to get out. So I always feel that it's sort of like the breath is like a string tied around our finger, and that before we entered this body, we kind of got this hook. The thread is like an electric cord, like we're plugged in. And it generates the energy that enables us to do this, right? And so it's here. And so we're doing this all the time. And then the question begins to enter our mind, you know, like, what is really happening here? What's animating this? And so we start going back in to try to ask the simple question, which Ramana Maharshi asked all the time, who am I? And we ask, who am I? What am I? And you want to answer that question on more and more subtle levels and peel away layer upon layer. And if you peel away personality and your body and all your likes and dislikes and all your attachments and all your relationships and all the everything that defines you, you really just come down more and more to you're just this expression of energy. And you start asking the question, where does the energy come from? And you begin to recognize that the energy is coming into us, at least through this breath. And so we, in the Hong Sa technique especially, you just look at it. You don't do anything about it. You just look at it. And you just ask the question, what is this? And the more you look at it, the more it begins to reveal itself as something quite other than just... It begins to show you on subtle levels what you're really all about. And there's no limit to that because it is the thread. And if you stay with it long enough until it disappears. And then the other side of it, which is using it, is that because breath is so fundamental, there's this extremely intimate relationship between the state of our mind and our breath. Our breath is very reflective of the state of our mind, and therefore, I mean, if you think about it, I know Shivani, when she would teach meditation, she used to say, wait a minute, do you hear that clock ticking? Like this. And then everyone would go. And then she would say, did you notice that almost all of you instinctively held your breath so that you could listen? Because if you're breathing, there's too much commotion and you can't hear us clearly. And so she would use that as an illustration of just sort of how the relationship is. And always, I mean, the very definition of being excited and out of control is that you're breathing really hard, you know? And it's just, you get all bad actors, you know, will show you that they're excited by just huffing and puffing, and it's so boring, but they're trying to show you that they're excited. Or we ourselves, if, you know, little children get so excited, they just, their breath, they just get all, you know, practically pass out with their excitement because the breath is just doing so much. So if we can become masters of our breath, it also gives us access to being masters of our minds. And that's why the state of being able to go breathless requires that the mind be still. Because as long as the mind is agitated, breath is required. And it works together. When the breath stills, the mind also goes quiet too. So all the different ways of using the breath are either, you know, I'm not an expert on all of that, but I'm sure each has some relationship to either some physiological shift, which will then create a consciousness shift, or something that works directly with consciousness by breathing in certain ways, certain kinds of energy and kinds of states can be drawn in. And it's also, it's like, it's always there. So it's something to focus on. And ultimately, it's the biggest distraction. So you take that which is the biggest distraction and you put it in the center, and then it's not a distraction anymore, it becomes the point of focus. Does that make sense? I know Swamiji said to Master once that he was having trouble going breathless, and Swamiji said that's because he used to talk a lot in past lives. And then Master said, well, at least you were happy in that. But meaning his mind had been very restless, and so he just had a karmic predisposition to not be able to calm it enough to go breathless. So there's all that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you covered this earlier somewhat, but I had a question on prayer, and that I think many of us have experienced saying a prayer or some affirmations and having what we wanted to show up miraculously in St. Jesus' name. But on the other hand, there's some things that we've prayed for and affirmed for many years and years, and nothing happens. We don't get a clue. And the energy is put out is the same, and yet some things work really well, and other things, and I'm not talking about praying for something superficial, I'm talking maybe a healing or a habit that we
The way Yogananda answered that is, he says, you never know how much of the nail is still in the wood. And so it's like, if you want something to happen and it's a righteous thing to have happen, if you keep doing the right things, eventually it will happen. Because if it's in tune with the divine, teach me to love you more, help me to overcome this weakness of mine, give me power over this delusion, you know, whatever it might be, it will eventually be fulfilled. But if there's this much of the nail in the piece of wood and you just give it a little tug, it comes out. If there's this much of the nail in the piece of wood, you're going to have to just pull on that for a really long time before it's ever going to come out. And you don't know how many incarnations you've been tugging at it. And that's why you have to be very detached. You have to do the right thing for the right reasons. If you're doing it for the results of it, it can just give you more bondage. And if you have to develop the faith to say, I'll just do what is the right thing to do, what choice do I have? And it's because the ego can't know what's going on. It's not a logical relationship between I did this much, therefore this will happen. Look, I did that yesterday and it worked over here, so I should do it over here, it should work over here. This is a false teaching that a lot of people put out about manifesting things. And they hit it lucky a few times and they think they really got the laws, but that's not so. It works if it's your karma to have it work. And if it's your karma, it's much bigger than just... You know, I was thinking about this in terms of the effort sometimes Swamiji has put out to help people spiritually. And most of the time, what he does bears fruit. But I had to say to myself, he's lost some big ones. You know, he's worked, he's poured his energy and his consciousness into quite a number of people over the years who apparently did not go the way he was hoping that they would go. And Master too. I mean, you know, Master wanted Richard Wright to become the president of SRF, and Richard Wright decided to go off and get married and do something else. And there were a number of people that Master had high hopes for, and they just didn't do it. So if a Master can't guarantee the results, it's certainly too much to hope that we can guarantee the results. We just do our best and know that sooner or later it will bear fruit, and that's where detachment is everything.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's just that, it's just so, I know we're talking like a lifetime, it's a very relative time, it's a very short period. But it's like something you can just lightly think about and they show up. And with myself, I've been praying for something since I was a situation to change since I was 16. And I get absolutely nowhere. I mean, not even a clue. And it just seems very...
Very what?
Unfair.
But see, that's the great challenge of life, Chris, is it appears to be very unfair. I mean, that is... Look, God's not going to... He's not going to...
I mean, if one could get a sign and say, well, look, this is why...
But Chris, wait.
This is what you need to work on to get the way you want.
If life fit our expectations and our comforts, it would be a different experience. I'm all for it fitting our expectations and our comforts. I think that would be a better system. But that isn't the system. So we can do one of two things. We can say, it should be different. Or we can say, okay, this seems to be how it's working. You know what this is? This is the little bird in the Festival of Light. God says, go out and do these certain things. The bird says, okay. Then the bird kind of gets out there, and he starts having experiences, and he starts thinking, hey, wait a minute, I'm not really so sure that this advice I got from God was so good, this business about sharing with everyone. I mean, I got all this stuff now, I got all this power, I like it like this. So the bird starts doing it his way. And then what happens to the bird? I mean, the bird starts running into storms and into dark and into lightning and crashes. I mean, what's that? That's all the things that don't go right for us. And so the bird says, hey, maybe I need to learn something. Instead of thinking that because I think it ought to be this way, it is this way, which is the stage that's called the revolt, we go on to the quest. And that's a very important word, the quest. Because the quest is the question, what is actually happening here? You know, God told me something, I tried out something else, I have not felt really terrific ever since I made that decision. You know, even though we lost, repeatedly we lost everything we had, we say that. We try it over and over, even though over and over we lose everything we have. So then we go on the quest. We go on the quest to understand what is actually happening. And we're not willing to give up our ideas about things until they've been absolutely being smashed out of us. Repeatedly, we have to lose everything we have before we have the humility. And humility is the first step to say, maybe I don't really have it all quite together. And then we start trying to understand. And so then we have to start working backwards, Chris, from things like, golly, I thought this would work. I mean, I've been praying for it since I was 16 years old. It's supposed to work. But it doesn't. So now we have to ask a different question. Gosh, I wonder why. And the more we keep asserting, but it should, the more we're in revolt. We have to stop and say, this is what's happening. I wonder why. You know, none of my relationships work out. I wonder why. None of my efforts to make money work out. I wonder why. None of my little plans work out. I wonder why. And the answer isn't necessarily because I'm such a schmuck, you know. That's not necessarily the answer. The answer may just be that I have to try to tune in to God's plan instead of just being in revolt against God's plan. I have to quest after what's really true. And that's a stage that all of us are in, because all of us are in this sort of transition between I want it my way, it should come out the way I want it, and a willingness to say, golly, if it doesn't, maybe you could glue me in on what's supposed to happen. And we're between the stage of having the detachment and the openness to hear the answers, and the stage where we're still so attached to what we want to be true that we can't hear anymore. And eventually, we stop being tempted by what isn't true. In other words, this is still, I mean, all of us are like that. It's just like, I know so well how I ought to behave, and I'm so impressed by how often I don't. You know, just the other night, I was just falling asleep. I said to David, you know, I just don't get it. I'm so sincere. I just am so tired of the fact that I can't bring myself into harmony with what I know to be true, but I can't. That's also part of the way things are, you know? I mean, just that frustration is part of the revolt. Swamiji says on this tape, one of the tapes he sent, patience is the fastest path to God. He said, just patience, to just be, and he describes patience as the willingness to live right now. He said, just to be able to live right now, in exactly what's happening right now, That's what patience is. Not thinking ahead, not thinking behind, but just being patiently right here, right now. Well, I'm at the stage where it doesn't happen fast. So that's what's happening. Because if you just accept that, then you're not... See, otherwise you create a double layer. Not only are your prayers not working, but you're also playing this ego game of saying to God, you ought to run the universe according to my plans, not yours. And, you know, that's fine. You can do that for a really long time.
We want to help them out.
Yeah, and repeatedly we lost everything we had. I love that line every time I read it. Even though repeatedly we lost everything we had, we still didn't. Even though he did, he just kept on flapping away, flying by his own lines, until it just got so bad. And then he heard the voice say, "Surrender to me." And I love it. Peace awaits you in the unknown. He says, how can I fly in this darkness? It's not going my way. I mean, what that means is, it's dark. I don't get it. It doesn't look like what it's supposed to look like. My radar's not working. My light's out. The candle's not there. I can't do anything unless I know what's going on. And the voice says, surrender. You'll find that there's a wonderful peace on the other side of all that determination to have it your way. And after a time, I love that phrase, after a time, how long a time, after a time, and then there's the tiny rebel, you know. These are all the nuances of this thing. I mean, there was a little bird that flew out, but all of a sudden it becomes the tiny rebel. I just feel like I'm up there on Sundays, you know, and I just want to say, I feel like exaggerating. The tiny rebel. He surrendered and he found, oh, surprise, the Knights Council was true.
So how does that end again?
Pardon me?
Tell me how that ends again. Get the bird.
The bird. The tiny rebel surrendered and found the Knights Council true. Found himself soaring high above, surrendered to the wind, and my mind goes blank. And if anybody gives me a clue, I can remember it. He soars, he finds the Knight's Council true, that peace awaits in the mere known, and he found himself soaring joyously high above the clouds, because I will, you know, I'll surrender to me and I'll add your strength, my strength to yours. And then the bird begins to ask, where is the source? And they answer, sink it in the farthest depths of being in your own self. And that's the quest. I mean, he suffered enough, he surrendered, and then they began to give him answers. Which is where we are. We have some of those answers.
I'd like to take my hand.
Yeah. That's that wonderful poem, The Hound of Heaven, that Master liked so much. There's a tape somewhere with him saying it, and that's the whole poem about this beautiful poem of this man, who actually was an opium addict and had a very difficult life, the man who wrote the poem. And the poem is all about everywhere he went, whatever he tried to do, he just felt this pursuit. And you know, this frightening pursuit, he would hear the footsteps and he would see the shadow and he would run to something else. And he describes in beautiful poetic terms all the different worldly experiences that he kept having. But every time he would get into them, he would hear this ominous footsteps coming. And finally, there was no place else to hide. He cowered in the corner and this dark shadow starts coming over. And when he finally just gives up and the shadow comes, he realizes it's the caressing hand of the divine come to comfort him. And what he thought was the shadow was just the hand reaching out to help him. And that's the hound of heaven pursuing us through many lifetimes until we finally just realize that, as the last line says, something like, all that I took from thee I took not for thy harm, but so that thou wouldst seek it in my arms.
Not a punishing, harsh thing. It's such a gentle, loving, like a motherly gesture, fatherly.
But it's the end of the world as we know it, if it's the ego. I mean, that's the revolt. It's the tiny rebel. Just thinking that this is the only way it's going to work, and then having to surrender all of that false understanding. It's such a mess. It's really a big time mess. And nobody except the saints understand why it is, and the saints say it's fine. I can't answer it. I don't know. Yeah. As Swamiji often says, no one who's found God ever thinks it's a bad system, but all of us who haven't think it is.
Why can't the ones who found it, it's just explained to us, lowly beings?
But Chris, they are. That's what, I mean, what do you think all of this is? The Bible? But they can't explain it to us except we have to rise to understand it. They can't make it sensible if we don't change our consciousness, because our consciousness, as Vivekananda said it, the level of consciousness that asks the question, why did God make the world this way, cannot understand the answer. If you want to know how reality works, you have to get yourself on the level from which it can be known. And we sit here, I mean, that was Shivani once was in seclusion for a long time. And she came out, she went up to Swamiji. Shivani's a very strong girl, and not very tall, but extremely, extremely strong. And she came up to Swamiji and she just said, why? Why? Why is it the way it is? And Swami said to her, Shivani, even if I could tell you, he said, what difference would it make? He said, because your job is going to be exactly the same, which is that you have to alter your consciousness so that you perceive reality differently. And, if, you know, you think that it would make a difference if you had it all explained to you, but it wouldn't. It's the same job. And in the Bhagavad Gita, the whole dynamic between Krishna and Arjuna is that same dynamic. And I don't have the chapter and verse, but there's a scene, in essence, it's just like that. You know, when you know the Bhagavad Gita is this inner chapter of this story of the Mahabharata, and the Mahabharata is this incredible story of Arjuna and his brothers and these cousins having this enormous dispute over a kingdom. And there's an historical part to it, but it's of course an allegory between the two sides of our own nature for our inner consciousness. But in the story, which is just such a great story, there's so much effort by Arjuna and his brothers to avoid having to go to war with their cousins. I mean, it just goes on just agonizingly as the brother, the eldest brother, does everything but fight. So by the time they are at the battleground, you, the reader, are pretty convinced that they just have to get on with it and have this battle. And Arjuna should have been convinced too. And Arjuna's there with Krishna. But just before they start, Arjuna says, wait a minute, wait a minute. And then he makes Krishna pull the chariot off to the side. And Arjuna says, now come on, I mean, like, do we really have to fight this battle? And then he gives all these reasons why it would really be better not to. And, you know, it's not a good idea. And Krishna says back, and Krishna says two things. First, Krishna says to him, he said, you are using the words and the concepts of a wise person to mask the actions of a fool and a coward. He said, because what you're really doing is you're trying to throw up this philosophical screen because you, Arjuna, are just a scum and you don't have the courage to go out there and fight. And you don't have any loyalty to your brothers, and you know, your name is just mud as far as I'm concerned. I mean, Krishna's real harsh. It's all poetry, but he's really harsh. He just says, you know, Arjuna, you're just playing a game with me, which is that you just don't have the nerve to do it. And so you're asking me all these philosophical questions because you just don't have the nerve to do it. Now, that's a very interesting allegory, and what it's about is a lot of times we sit on the side and we say, well, you know, if I just really understood, if I just had a revelation of how, you know, why it is like this, well then, of course, I would really get engaged. But, you know, until I understand this, I mean, I think it would be insincere, you know, to really do it. I mean, I'm exaggerating it, but we do that too, you know. And really, it's just using philosophical words to cover the fact that we don't have the courage to get into the game. But Arjuna did it, so I figured we're in good company. But every time you find your mind spinning on a question that can't be answered and acting as if I only had the answer to that, then I would behave differently, you have to ask yourself, really? You know, would I really behave differently? Or am I just trying to find a way to stay out of the game? That's why Shivani answered her that way. What difference would it make, Shivani? You're thinking for it to have this answer, but you know you're going to have to get up and meditate every morning just the same. And you have just the same problems, it's really not going to make any difference to you. When you realize it, when you reach that stage of consciousness, it will make a difference. But when you just get the words exchanged, it won't make any difference. Does that make sense? It's a very important point. That's why it's just better to do it rather than to understand it. That's why the master don't have a lot of sympathy with a whole lot of questions. There's that story of Yogananda's life when that man came with all the intellectual questions. And master answered the first question by saying, love God. He answered the second question by saying, love God. He answered the third question by saying, love God. And then he got up and walked out. Because there was nothing to be gained by answering the questions. It has to come from a different level. But, I mean, we're fortunate. We're incredibly fortunate because, you know, our teacher taught in English and Kriyananda made it even more into English. And so we can satisfy enormous levels of our intellectual questions. It's just very gratifying for people like us. I mean, I just thank God every day that you know, we could have had a guru who spoke no English or never spoke. You know, then we really would just be stuck. But we didn't, so we couldn't have a halfway point. But we have to treat it appropriately. Yes, Dina.
Do you have any Well, you always have words of wisdom. But any advice for, let's say I stopped writing, but I don't yet feel God's hand. I mean, I don't know where it is. I know it's there. And I it's like a transition. My whole past is, you know, I left it. And this is a new life for me, and it's scary. And
I think you should practice the teachings. I mean, the Guru's given us, I mean, this path, assuming that's what you're following, or whatever path you're following, if you're following this path, just start at the beginning. Learn and do energization, learn and do yoga postures, learn and do Hong Sa. Just, you know, read Whispers from Eternity. Just take every specific guidance that is there, and insofar as you can, just consistently and steadily just do what the Guru asked you to do. And that's the best you can do, and then don't think about it. Because if you're doing the right thing, everything in future will improve. And if you don't get what you want, well, there you are. You will, eventually. You won't get it any faster by giving up. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what you have to say to yourself, is what I mean. You have to say, well, so what? I mean, I think it's lovely if we get comforted. I love to be comforted. I hate it when I'm not. But if I'm not, so what? Well, what choice do I have? That's what you have to come to. And that's, I mean, that's the bottom line you have to ask yourself. Like Peter answered Jesus, will you too also leave me? Peter said, where would I go? I love that answer. Because Peter didn't say, oh, this is so terrific. I understand everything. I've got my act together. I know what's going on here. He just said, where would I go? Meaning, I just don't have a choice. So even if this is a mess, it's less of a mess than leaving. So here I am. And you just need to cut through. When your mind starts spinning like this, just go all the way to here and say, well, even if all that's true, where would I go? That's gotten me out of a lot of moods. I just say, well, where is this going? This is going to suicide. I'm not going to commit suicide. And I'm not going to leave the path, so what's the point? Just get up and get on with it. And that helps. And everything in future will improve. You know, if you're having a bad incarnation, the best way to have a better one next time is just do your best now. And just, you know, say, well, at least I'm writing off a little bad karma. I can't always be that brave either, but I do find that these extreme answers save me a lot of trouble. Because even if I can't follow them, I don't waste time trying to find others. I surrender and just wait until I'm ready to do what I know I need to do. My, you know, my life's gotten simpler and simpler the more I've been on the path. It's not that I don't have the same ups and downs, although I do have less of them, but the solutions are simpler. Because I don't spin out as many hopeless theories. I just cut right to the ones that I know are true. I remember last year at Spiritual Renewal, I think when I stood up to speak, or the year before, when we were right in the middle of all the hell we went through here. And I said, well, this is the period of time in which we don't quit. This is not the period of time in which we're having any fun. But this time is the period of time when we don't quit, and that is success. And sometimes that's all you can say. At least I didn't quit. You can just sort of imagine him say to Master at the end, I didn't quit! You know? And that may be really a big thing to say at that point. Well, on that note, shall we do some ohms and pray?
Facing the spine of the cosmic center. Center.